and putting the burden on the middle and the bottom. And all we are asking people like Bernie Sanders, or for that matter me, is that we go back to what we had, especially when you remember that the 50s and 60s, when we taxed the rich, we had rates of economic growth much faster than we've had now that we don't tax them anymore. We have lower kinds of economic development because we help the rich, which is bizarre because the argument for helping the rich has always been that's what you need to do to get economic growth. But the actual history of the United States is the reverse.
We want to thank you for being with us, Richard Wolff, professor emeritus of economics at University of Massachusetts Amherst, visiting professor at New School University, has written a number of books. Among his latest is the book Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism. Also has a radio show that broadcasts on Pacifica radio stations and community radio stations around the country called Economic Update. That does it for our show. If you'd like a copy, go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Mate, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Kofani Masood, Rabbi Karen, Dina Guster, Amy Littlefield. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8 o'clock. Coming up next is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with our hosts Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. This week, the citizens of Greece rejected the austerity economics of the European Union. Should we care? Tune in and find out.
Attention KBOO members and listeners. The KBOO Foundation is seeking to fill four upcoming vacancies on the Board of Directors. Terms run 3 years, beginning on October 1st. The nomination packet, due July 11th, is posted on the KBOO website and paper copies are available at the station. Candidates must submit the completed nomination packet via email to kboocommunity@gmail.com or mail or drop off the completed nomination packet, care of Timothy Welp, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Incomplete forms will not be considered as fulfilling the statement of interest requirement by the KBOO bylaws. Packets are due by Saturday, July 11th. The candidate statements submitted as part of the nomination packet will be posted to KBOO's website, and candidates will be expected to participate in an interview for broadcast and a Q&A session at the annual meeting. For more information, please contact the nominating committee at kboocommunity@gmail.com.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present The Harder They Come as part of the KBOO at the Clinton monthly film series. The Harder They Come is a 1972 Jamaican crime film. With dreams of becoming a successful reggae singer, a young Jamaican man, played by Jimmy Cliff, finds corruption from his record producers and the drug pushers they're connected to. Again, that's The Harder They Come, Thursday, July the 9th at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. As sure as the sun will shine, I'm gonna get my share right now. What's mine? And then the harder they come, the harder they fall. One and all.
Should it be harder for landlords to evict their tenants for no reason at all?
Should safe and healthy homes come before the interests of private investment?
Is the rent too damn high?
If you answered yes to any of these questions, join us for the next Portland Renters Assembly.
KBOO is a proud sponsor of the Portland Renters Assembly, a gathering of people united by the burden of rent and committed to housing as a human right.
The next two assemblies are on Sunday, July 12th, from 12 to 2 p.m. at the North Portland Library, with speakers on how race intersects with gentrification.
And on Wednesday, July 15th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at Colonel Sumner's Park, with speakers on community organizing and mobilizing.
Tell your story and join the conversation. For more information, go to kboo.fm and click on Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Tom Dwyer Automotive Services, a full-service automotive shop located next to Portland's Selwood Bridge for over 30 years. They're a Blue Seal certified shop committed to client care and community support. Information on their eco certification, client carbon neutral program, courtesy shuttle, rentals, and more at tomdwyer.com or by calling
We've exhausted our Greek stereotypes now.
Oh yeah, we've done our Greek stereotyping, and it's time to tell you that this is KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial in Portland, Oregon. That this is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. That's Abe Proctor. I'm Joe Uris, and the number to call to talk on the radio at the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Station Radio Show. Pardon me, 231-8187. We're going to talk about Greece.
Yes, we are.
We're going to talk about finance.
Yes, we are.
We're going to talk about the European Union.
We are.
We're going to talk about some really serious disasters and some alternatives that exist. And the absolute, how shall I put it, stupidity of mainstream media in dealing with all this.
Yeah,
at least
okay.
I will.
That's quite a bit on our plate today.
It's a lot of plate. It's a lot of plate we have on. Or something.
Right. Your syntax, as ever, sir, is sterling.
My syntax is taxing.
Yeah.
So, we do want to hear from you. We do want to discuss finance. I would think it would be a good time not to have a conversation about how the Republic is really a fascist thing or whatever. I'm tired of that argument.
Okay.
So, you know.
All right.
But
okay.
That's just advisory. Provisional. Okay.
All right, Greece.
Greece.
Okay. Over the weekend, the Greeks had a referendum. Everybody showed up to the polls.
They
voted to reject the latest round of terms offered them by their creditors in Europe.
Well, basically by the Germans.
Basically by the Germans being the largest creditors
in
Europe. The wealthiest and largest economy in Europe, the Germans. Why is this important? Well, it's important for a number of reasons. So we're going to jump back in time here to 2008. Remember what happened in 2008? What happened, Joe?
Well, enormous sums of money were loaned under most bad conditions to both nations and corporations and people and householders and so on, with no expectation by the lenders that they would actually ever be able to pay back.
Okay, that's a reasonable answer. The one I was looking for is global economic collapse.
Oh, okay.
Global economic collapse.
Global economic collapse.
In 2008. Now, this happened out on a worldwide scale, as I just mentioned. Now, countries chose to deal with this in a number of ways.
Right.
Here in the United States, if you recall, the newly elected president, Barack Obama, inherited this situation from his predecessor, passed his stimulus bill. Do you remember that?
I do.
Now, there was a lot that was wrong with the stimulus bill.
Yes.
Primarily, it was not large enough, nor broad enough, nor rich enough, really, to truly do
right.
what it was
intended wasn't,
to do.
It wasn't what Roosevelt did in the Great Depression.
It was not what Roosevelt did in the Great Depression. I'm glad you brought that up, because that's a fundamental difference between the response here in the United States, as watered down as it was, and the response in the European Union. One was, to categorize them very broadly, one was a demand-side solution, the other a supply-side solution. One, you could say, was characterized by generosity, the other by austerity. Here in the United States, we experienced the generous side of things, such as it was. The Europeans experienced the austere side, such as it was. So what does that mean exactly? Well, here in the United States, the president's stimulus package essentially sought to put money in the pockets of ordinary working people in a number of ways, by expanding and extending unemployment benefits, other sorts of familial support, food stamps and so on, by getting the government into the hiring business, by building infrastructure projects and hiring Americans to work on them, all with the idea that money in the pockets of consumers drives the economy, lifts the economy out of recession. Essentially spending your way out of recession.
Right, because if people have money, they buy stuff.
If people have money, they buy stuff. And that causes a virtuous cycle.
Right.
People buy stuff, demand for stuff goes up. Consequently, suppliers, seeing that increased demand, start hiring more people so that they can produce more stuff to meet the demand for that stuff.
Right.
It's a virtuous cycle.
Yes.
That was opposed vigorously here in the United States by the Republican Party, who want to do away with the notion that government can, in fact, be a positive economic force, particularly in times of depression or recession.
Right.
So hence in the United States, we got the sort of watered down stimulus bill that did a lot of these things, but not enough of them. Europe got none of the good stuff and all of the bad stuff. And we'll take Greece as an example because it's the most glaring example of the crisis that that we faced in 2008. Spain to a lesser extent, but Greece is the worst. So what happened in Greece? Global economic collapse happened. Greece was faced with the fact that it could not repay its debts,
right,
as a nation. Greece found itself in a particularly bad spot because it was part of the Eurozone, meaning it no longer had its own currency.
That's really important.
Really important. In fact, probably the linchpin of this entire discussion. When a state has its own currency, it has a much greater level of control over its economic destiny.
Right, it can devalue the currency, it can do all kinds of things.
It can devalue its currency primarily, and I'm glad you mentioned that. Why is that important? Because, for example, if the country is not able to pay off its debts and it controls its own currency, it can essentially print more money so that it can pay off those debts. Now, that has an inflationary effect, the devaluation you just talked about, meaning that it takes more of whatever that money is to buy basic goods and services. That's inflation. That's the downside of devaluation. But what the devaluation can allow a country to do is to continue to pay off its debts, to sort of stop its free fall, to sort of pause and catch its breath and try and find its economic footing again. Examples of this happening very effectively in the post-2008 era were in Iceland.
Yes.
And a little bit earlier in Argentina.
Right.
There's a dark side to devaluation. You imagine Germany after the First World War, where people were wheeling wheelbarrows full of Deutschmarks down the road to buy a loaf of bread.
Right.
That's runaway devaluation, runaway inflation. That's a bad thing. So a country in Greece's situation tries to find that happy medium between some devaluation and the chance at eventual economic growth.
But it can't.
It can't because it doesn't have its own currency.
Right, because what happened in Europe was, before there was really a united Europe,
yep,
before there was really a consensus on any of this by the people of Europe,
yep,
there was the creation of a currency union, not a national bank or international bank, not a real structure or infrastructure for economic change, but rather an overlay of assumptions built around a banking system that was,
yep,
very fragile.
Right, and sort of this overarching idea of a unified Europe, which people were more or less behind and still are.
Yeah.
But in practical terms, this means that the European Union is much more like a confederacy than a federation, if that makes any sense.
Yes, it does.
Yes. The individual states that make up the European Union have more autonomy than the individual states that make up the United States, by way of comparison. For example, what happened in Greece is very much as if Louisiana owed a bunch of money to New York, and New York says, well, you got to put aside all your other concerns, and you got to pay us back right now, or we're going to kick you out of the United States. Essentially, that's the situation Greece is in.
I think with Texas, that would be a good thing.
Right. Yeah, maybe. There are limits to my analogies, ladies and gentlemen. All right, so we talked a little bit ago about the difference between stimulus demand-side solutions and austerity, supply-side solutions. In the United States, we responded to the crisis by putting money in people's pockets, by putting people to work. In Greece, the lender nations in Europe, mostly Germany, said to Greece, Well, you got to pay us back. And what's more, you got to make that your top priority. You've got to drastically cut government services across the board so that you can pay us back. That's austerity.
And I want to make something clear here. The lenders were as irresponsible in Europe as they were previously to bring about the disaster of 08.
Yeah.
And Goldman Sachs was a leader of this, and it still is. So what essentially the banking and investment community does is it persuades people to borrow money, which there's no real expectation of their ability necessarily to repay.
Right. So you hear about the Troika in this conversation. When you hear the word Troika, that means a group of three very large and powerful institutions. One, the European Commission, which is the de facto central government in Europe. Second, the International Monetary Fund, whose misdeeds are legion. And third, the European Central Bank, right, which is a proxy essentially for Germany. German bankers control the European Central Bank.
And to be also clear, the historic origins of the IMF rest in Bretton Woods, which was a conference held after or toward the end of World War II, in which the World Bank was created and the emergency bank, the IMF, were created.
Right.
All of which were to be dominated by the United States.
Right. So on the ground in Greece, what does this mean? The Greek government, in order to stay solvent, in order to meet the demands of its creditors, had to slash government services drastically. So we're talking about public education, transportation, healthcare, and on and on and on and on. What this meant is that there was very little liquid capital around to invest in anything or to pay workers anything. Unemployment lagged in the mid 20% range. Think about that for a second. Can you imagine? Imagine for a moment 25% unemployment in the United States.
Yeah, one in four people who can work not working.
Yeah. Here we panicked. We panicked in the economic collapse when unemployment got around 10%. Now imagine it in 25 to 30% range. That's what we're talking about in Greece. With no public services, no safety net to turn to, every last bit of extra capital that was being generated was being handed over to the banker nations in Northern Europe, the central bank, to keep Greece solvent. Essentially extending a series of bridge loans, not really getting at the underlying debt problem, keeping them barely afloat, and with all prospects of recovery essentially sacrificed on the altar of austerity. You got to pay back your loans, Greece. You got to pay back your loans.
Well, and also this whole ideological fantasy of austerity as a solution to economic crisis, which has never worked.
It has never worked, but it's taken as an article of faith amongst economic conservatives, much as it is here in this country.
Right.
What was the proposed solution on the political right in the United States to the tragedy of 2008?
Well, austerity.
Austerity. Tax cuts.
Yeah.
For the wealthy.
For the rich. Always tax cuts for the rich.
Right. There was nothing about maybe bailing out the homeowners who are facing eviction from their houses.
Certainly not. It's their fault.
It's their fault. And to help them would be a moral hazard.
Yes.
Right.
Right.
Remember that phrase.
Moral
hazard. To help out
hazard.
Struggling indebted households would be a moral hazard. The same logic was applied to Greece. Helping out Greece would be a moral hazard because you got to pay back your debts, which is generally true. But in times of crisis, different solutions are needed. We kind of got it right here in the United States, and we should be thankful for that fact.
A little right.
A little right.
Not much. Not really enough.
Virtually every independent economic analysis of President Obama's stimulus bill has shown that we would have been significantly worse off.
That's true.
If not for those efforts.
That is absolutely true.
Obama, in fact, tried again later in his first term and early in his second to introduce something called the American Jobs Act, which would have been more of that sort of demand-side stimulus spending. Of course, it was roundly rejected by the Republican-controlled Congress. So what does this have to do with Greece? Greece got tired of all this crap that was being handed to it by the European Central Bank, said, you know what? We are no longer going to sacrifice the well-being of our people on the altar of debt repayment. We reject your terms. So now Greece is at an impasse. It has said, no, we're not going to pay you back, European Central Bank. We're not going to do it. I'm sorry. We're going to have to figure something else out. So now the European Union is faced with two very difficult choices. One is, sorry, Greece, we're going to cut you loose. You're no longer part of the Eurozone. You're on your own. Secondly, it would need to embrace something besides years and years of austerity policies. And that would start with writing off some or all of Greece's debts so that it can begin once again to take care of its own people.
Yeah, I think it's historically important to understand what Greece is about. In World War II, the Greek partisans, who were largely communists, successfully fought the Nazis in that war. Mm-hmm. This was very significant. At the end of World War II, there was a great struggle between the communists and other forces for control of Greece and, incidentally, Turkey. And the consequence of that was something called the Truman Doctrine, which essentially loaned vast sums of money and weaponry to conservatives to fight the left. And it was a reasonably successful program. But what it didn't deal with and what it couldn't deal with is the spirit. And I think that's the best word to use, the zeitgeist of Greek independence and Greek freedom. And this tradition going way back still exists in Greece, still existed in Greece, as it did in Spain, by the way, as it does in several countries. And the result of that, ethos and that zeitgeist is a inherent resistance to oppression. This is something that is not calculable. It's not measurable in economic terms, but it has an enormous impact. The vote, which was very practical, I believe, against yielding to the demands of Germany and others who hold the debt this last Sunday, is not surprising in that context. In fact, the poorer communities, the more working class communities, the intellectual communities, and young people essentially were the people who rejected largely the demand for return of what? The gaining of the money that Greece really didn't have, and the austerity that would be implied, which was not austerity like, you don't have a TV set. It was austerity like, you don't have health care. Oh, right. You don't have enough food.
Or you don't have education.
Or no education, or whatever. It was really severe.
And it's important to notice that this all has to be taken with a nice heaping spoonful of hypocrisy, because there's always hypocrisy at play when big sums of money are involved, wouldn't you say?
Here's
why that's the case. Greece has a leftist government that was elected in its last election, mainly on a platform of rejecting austerity politics. That government went about trying to get at an estimated 100 billion euros or more that had been stashed by its 1%, its wealthiest citizens, in various tax havens in Europe. Mm-hmm. These efforts were stonewalled by the very bankers who are demanding that Greece repay its money. So Greece was like, well, okay, we need money. We're going to try to get this money that our richest citizens essentially stole. But the very bankers who are clamoring for us to repay are saying, no, you can't have that money. Because that belongs to the ruling class. You can't have that.
Right. And this is
hypocrisy.
And this is, to a lesser extent, true in every Western nation.
Right.
And Russia.
Right.
As a matter of fact.
So one would hope that the outcome of this is that Greece remains in the Eurozone, that the central bank bows to reality and says, well, quality of life, basic human dignity in Greece means more than the principle that the idea that this money needs to be repaid.
So where they'd write it off, but that's a moral hazard.
Well, not really. Well, let's weigh that for a second. What's the greater moral hazard, listeners? The idea, the principle, the notion that borrowed money must be repaid no matter what, or the economic, spiritual, emotional, and physical health of an entire country full of people?
Really?
Which of those represents the greater moral question?
This is a very good point at which to invite people to call us. And remember, it's 231-8187, and we do want to hear from you.
Let's go to the phones. Who do we have? Clem, good morning.
Do I have you, Joe?
Yeah, what?
Yeah, we're here.
Okay, I just want to make a couple points. I don't want to take up too much of your time.
Okay.
But since 1945, there have been over 20 million GIs stationed in Germany. Close to 22 million, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
During that time, they've been spending their monthly pay there. Their dependents have been there spending money. And the U.S. government has been paying for goods and services at various installations over there. Mm-hmm. Talk about a stimulus.
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting point, and it's a good point. Essentially, the economic miracle that happened to Germany was largely because of a fear of Soviet power and Soviet takeover of Europe, but also because the rebuilding of capitalism was in the interest of those people who are the wealthy.
In 1953, the Germans got the U.S. and Britain and France to forgive one half of the incurred debt as a result of two wars and a depression. Mm-hmm. And the excuse was the Soviet Union.
Right.
And one more point I want to make out. It's interesting to note that the Brits, British government, good or bad, was smart enough to join in the Eurozone. Can you imagine an Englishman having to pay for a product using a bill with a picture of de Gaulle on it?
Well, that's just a funny image.
Hey, thank you for that call. That was pretty funny.
Yeah. Well, and in fact, one of the things that happened, that a minor, really minor point, is that all the pretty currencies of Europe disappeared and the ugly industrial style money appeared. I thought that was a bad aesthetic sign.
Yeah, horrible.
It's a petty thing. I'm sorry. It's just how I think about it.
All right. So we're talking about the question of Greek repayment of death and the larger question of what does and does not constitute a moral hazard.
Yes.
It is the position of the European Central Bank that the failure of Greece to repay its loans would be an unacceptable moral hazard. Well, let's think about this for just a second. In 2008, in the United States, a number of major financial institutions were left essentially holding the bag for their own crimes when a whole bunch of investors demanded repayment on toxic assets sold to them by those banks, and the banks were unable to do so. What did they do?
They
turned to taxpayers for a bailout because they were unable to cover the cost of their own misbehavior.
And they got that bailout.
They got that bailout, and not a single one of them went to jail. Now, in my opinion, that is a moral hazard.
On a big scale.
On a big scale. So what this vote represents in Greece, and hopefully if things play out as they should, this will be proof positive of two very important things. First, that the politics and the economics of austerity do not work. They are a recipe for economic stagnation and misery. Secondly, that a people-positive economics, an investment in putting people to work and putting money in the pockets of ordinary people, investment in crucial infrastructure like transportation, education, healthcare, all of these things pave the way towards sustainable economic growth. That is the question. That is what needs to be resolved by what happens in Greece. Chances are this will happen, and then the corporate-owned media will try and distract you with something else.
Well, yes.
Because it's the threat of a good example.
Right. Yes, that's a very, very good point. And in fact, what we're seeing in mainstream media now is lack of information, a total propagandistic approach, an assumption that the capital markets are the sole legitimate holders of wealth, and that they alone can be the arbiters of the future of nations like Greece or the United States, for that matter.
Yeah.
So let's go to the phones again. 231-8187. John, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Yeah.
Hey, it's Sean.
Sean, sorry.
Oh, that's all right. You know, if our goals are environmental sanity and economic equality,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to throw my support behind the Greek Communist Party. All of this talk about economic growth, what we desperately need is degrowth. We need to be shrinking the size of the economy. A Camry or a Cadillac in every driveway, that spells the death of the planet. So it seems like we need massive economic central planning so that we can accomplish our two goals of environmental sanity and economic equality. And the only way you can accomplish that is through the complete abolition of market economics. If you think about somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 trillion being spent every year in the U.S. on marketing, advertising, public relations to get people to buy more and more and more crap that they don't really need, there's no room left for that kind of an economic model if we want anything resembling economic equality and environmental sanity. And so in the discussion about Greece, it really rubs me the wrong way when I hear people talk about stimulus and promoting economic growth. No, we need to be shrinking the economy. Time over stuff.
Yeah, I don't agree. Well, what do you think, Joe?
Well, I agree in larger principle. But there are so many issues involved. I come up with a petty with a petty example. Well, you're telling me that I can't in my old age have a Barca lounger?
That's exactly what I'm telling you.
Okay, man. Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you for the call. I don't think it's an either-or proposition. I don't think the answer lies in complete centralization and planning of the economy and the abolition of private markets, nor do, as conservatives in this country advocate, nor do I think the answer lies in unfettered, unrestrained market-based solutions to everything.
Well, it seems like what you're saying is that it's some kind of social democratic approach.
Yes, a very heavily regulated and muzzled capitalist economy.
Ah.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. What about breaking up the big banks?
I'm all in favor of it.
Okay.
Yeah. Too big to fail means shouldn't exist. If you build an institution, a lending institution, a finance institution that's whose collapse would endanger the overall economy, then that's just too damn big.
Well, that is the case, and here we are.
Yeah.
All right, let's hear from you. 231-8187. We're talking about the Greek crisis.
Michael, good morning.
Good morning, guys.
Hey, how's up?
Well, I got a small point and a larger point to tell you.
Okay.
Okay, the small point. Roosevelt's, whatever he did during the Depression, did not end the Depression. The New Deal. Well, you know, the economic parts of that. What ended the Depression was mobilizing the country for World War II. So, I mean, if you say you want to follow Roosevelt's policies to get us out of economic trouble, what we need is a really large war. If that's how you want to do it.
Well, that, Michael, that's an oversimplification, I think, things went. Roosevelt's policies were pulling us out of the Depression before we got into World War II. What World War II did, that was essentially demand-side economics on steroids. What the war did was realize full employment in the United States and put a whole bunch of money into the pockets of a whole bunch of people.
Well, you know, there was the Depression in the Depression and stuff. Maybe it was pulling us out, but it wasn't getting us far out. It was the war that pulled us out. But anyway, the main point I want to say, I mean, the important thing, which is about Greece,
yes,
is that the markets have already factored in that Greece is never going to repay its debts. This whole thing right now is not about Greece repaying its debts. That's not the problem. The problem is, like, let's say you had a neighbor and it was really cold in the winter and your neighbor was freezing to death because their furnace was broken. And they pleaded with you to lend them money to fix the furnace. And you said, well, okay, I don't want you guys to freeze to death. So you lent them the money, and the next thing they did was they threw a big party and spent all the money, and they still didn't have a furnace, and now they wanted more money. The problem isn't that they figure Greece is going to repay their debts. The problem is Greece wants more money, and after what Greece did with the money they already gave them, they don't really feel more money down that rat hole.
Let me deconstruct some of what you said, because I think you're making an interesting point. In fact...
No, he's not. He's just arguing for austerity. But okay. Go ahead.
In fact, look, the holding of vast amounts of wealth by the Greek upper class is a major and central causal force in all of this. That's number one. Number two, the money was being spent on important basic needs of the Greek people. You can't ignore that. You can't say, oh, people shouldn't. It isn't like the furnace is not being fixed and people are buying cars or something. The fact of the matter is that schooling, healthcare, transportation systems, and so on, infrastructure, crucially needed upgrade and needed improvement. And this is where the bulk of that money was destined to go, except for the fact that the bulk of the wealth of Greece was in the hands of a very small oligarchy that still holds all the money.
Well, you know, the other aspect to that is that the Greeks basically don't pay taxes. And their system is incredibly corrupt. And part of the hope they gave them the money the first time was that the Greeks will use this money to fix their system. That's what I kind of meant about fixing the furnace in the house, you know. And they didn't fix it. They still don't pay taxes, and they're still corrupt. And, you know, if the Europeans, you know, the Germans basically, put a whole bunch more money into Greece, it'll go down that same rat hole. And how long do you expect Germany to support Greece?
As we mentioned earlier, the very bankers who are demanding repayment are also enabling the corruption amongst the upper classes in Greece by helping those people shelter their money.
Well, remember that what I said was that no one expects Greece to repay the debts ever. That's already been factored in. The point is, are we going to pour more money in there? And I don't think if it was your money and you saw what happened, you would be so anxious to pour it in there.
Well, look, the question really now, from the point of view of real politics, is does Greece move away from the European Union, move to a drachma of its own, which essentially is devaluing what was the euro? Does that begin to break up the plan for a European Union? That's really where this is at this point. You're right in that it is very unlikely that Greece could ever repay the debt.
And everybody knows that.
Yeah.
So it's not about them repaying the debt like Abe, I guess, or maybe both of you were saying. It's not about that. It's about, you know, is it a good use of more money to pour more money into Greece right now? And I don't think, I seriously...
If it's not about repaying the debt, then why is the central bank still demanding that Greece repay the debt?
Because, you know, there's like rhetoric and pressure and all, but, you know, that repayment has already been devalued by the markets, I read. And that's not actually the point. But how much more money do you expect? Would you pour money into Greece if it was your money?
It's not my money. That's an irrelevant argument.
No, it's not irrelevant. Because, you know, all money is somebody's money. If you're a German, do you want your money to be, quote, invested, unquote, in Greece? Do you? It's your money.
Let's go back to the New York versus Louisiana analogy we had before. If Louisiana was continuing to suffer... And if Louisiana's government was corrupt and was misusing...
Is corrupt, misusing
the money that I in New York was giving to them, I would want that money to go into the pockets of the ordinary people in Louisiana so that they could go out and spend it. So I might make some demands, but I would give them the money because it would salvage basic human dignity and basic economic stability in Louisiana.
Beyond that, because you, Michael, like to talk about fundamentals, the fundamental reality is that the capital in Greece was grabbed up over a long period of time by a very, very isolated oligarchy under the encouragement of the West, and that's where we're at.
Well, there's a different way to describe that, which is, they put money into Greece, and they said, okay, we're giving you this money, but you got to reform things. And they didn't enforce it. They may not have had a way to enforce it, and Greece didn't do the reforms and blew the money. And now
Greece did do the reforms. Greece submitted to all the austerity demands that the central bank gave them. They slashed government services across the board. They put up with stagnating levels of unemployment, all to conform to the demands placed upon them by the central bank. None of that worked. Greece is still languishing in the same situation it was. The Greek example is proof that austerity economics do not work.
I think we're really having two kinds of arguments here. And I think that the one that both Abe and I are most interested in is the notion that austerity economic responses are somehow a way to work your way out of depressions or recessions.
Okay. Let me give you the mirror image of that one. The mirror image of that one is this. The history of the Chinese economy before they went capitalist was proof that communism doesn't work.
Forget communism. That's not
or
even
socialism.
An issue.
Socialism.
We're going to have to give some others a chance, Michael.
That's
but
fine.
Thank you, as always, for your comments.
Right. Bye-bye.
Bye. Who else we got, Steve? Richard, good morning.
Hi.
Thanks
for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have one little comment. I mean, I know the Truman Doctrine has got us into trouble, but around this election time with all this talk about redistributing the wealth and the money and so forth, I'm concerned about environmental sanity, and I'm concerned that in this discussion that's going on, it's a distraction from the underlying, and it's talking about a kind of class warfare, really. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that goes on, but I'm concerned that takes us away from the real central issue of environmental sanity. My issue is not with the inheritance of my children for whatever money I have left. My concern is how many fresh air credits will they get when they're born? We're in dire straits about what's going on across classes. And until we focus on that and get the oligarchs or whoever it is that has all the money in the corporations to begin to change their consciousness, to think in the long-range terms about the good of the hive, the good of the species, we're really doing ourselves a great disservice by being distracted solely into these economic warfare arguments. I think they're important to have, but I want to see more about environmental sanity injected into these conversations so so that we don't just get polarized and pitted against one another with supply side versus demand side economics, and that the polarization of the populace by the political classes is taking us away from the central issue that involves us all. They have co-opted the arguments to put it in terms of economics, and that gets people's dander up, and we're not doing anything about the consciousness of all classes that we really have to deal with the environmental
problem
long term. That's all I want to say.
No, I appreciate it. I think in a very profound sense you're right, but we really not, also need to focus on who holds the money and how they use that money and how they don't spread it around.
We also need to educate them and be patient with them and compassionate to understand that they're afraid of what's going to happen if they lose their Cadillacs. We have to do something about that. And I'm just saying that piece needs to be injected in these conversations.
Okay.
Don't just say yes, but to me, that's all. I agree with you. Carry on. I had my injection in there, and I really appreciate what
you're
doing.
Thanks so much for
your show.
And I appreciate your point. I think it's a good point. Thank you very much for the call.
I don't think cultivating economic stability and environmental health are mutually exclusive.
They don't need to be.
They don't need to be.
Good. Keep saying that.
Yeah, exactly.
Keep saying that. Tell those oligarchs that.
Hey, thank you for the call. Now, here's what I mean. We talked about the effectiveness of demand-side stimulus in this country. We pointed to the New Deal as a practical example of that, mm-hmm. and to a lesser extent, Obama's stimulus package. If a government decides, for example, to create a jobs program, it can do that in an environmentally beneficial way.
Right.
For example, say the United States government says, I've got this big pile of money. I'm going to use it first to educate and train workers, and then I'm going to put them to work building wind farms and building solar farms.
And high-speed rail.
And high-speed rail. And it can extend into other sectors, too. I could put them to work installing high-speed fiber optic networks, and on and on and on. These don't have to be mutually exclusive goals.
I agree.
Let's go back to the phones. James, good morning.
Good morning.
Okay.
So that guy before Richard, it just, what he was talking about just seems like the same kind of argument that we have here when we extend welfare benefits, SNAP benefits to people in whose economies are already suffering because jobs being pushed out of the city. And it's just like, basically saying that, oh, it was a waste of money to give to the Greeks, when in reality, you're right, spending money on basic infrastructure and needs that need to be met in order to be able to improve the quality of life for people is
right.
not a waste
right.
of money. And it's kind of like when you hear people talking about, like, oh, I was in line with a person and they paid for all their food with a SNAP card, but then they've got, like, an iPhone 6. And they want to be like, well, what are they doing with an iPhone 6? It almost kind of seems like, they need that. It's like, who can I be mad at about the state of things in order to make myself feel better about what little bit that I've gained from my...
Well, and I think you're right. I think one of the things that has happened in the United States and most of Western Europe, in fact, a lot of the world, is a total dismissal of the notion of a shared environment, of a shared world, of a shared infrastructure, and so on. And we've essentially developed a kind of moral, a bizarre moral notion that wealth is the answer to all problems. And I think that quite the opposite, that the, the more we can, and this is not to put an end to capitalism, by the way, but the more we can put money in the hands of working people, the more they can buy stuff. Now, this raises the issue of environmental wisdom, but the more they can buy stuff, the more the owners of stuff making can hire people to make the stuff, and the better the economy. We are now at the stage where illogically we are pushing constantly against that reality, and where we are getting our stuff is from a country like China, or Vietnam for that matter, where the working people are not free.
Yeah, and and more importantly, realizing that the fact that, we have in our country as well, we do have a small central oligarchy where everybody's eating up the money. People want to look around and talk about, it just seems like all the mainstream media media wants to put all of the burden on the people who have the least amount of money, but nobody's taking into account that, you know, the large corporations like Walmart, CVS pharmacies, Walgreens, where they're taking all of their headquarters, and they're moving them to places where they do not have to pay taxes.
Right, you're absolutely right.
And so if these large oligarchical corporations actually started paying their fair share of taxes, we would see a lot of our problems go away almost seemingly overnight. Because
you're absolutely correct.
A huge flux of money into the economy, but nobody wants to look at that. Everybody wants, you know.
Agreed. The concentration of wealth is a huge gaping structural flaw in the current economic order. There's no doubt about it.
Yes, true.
Anyway, thank you very much for the call.
Appreciate your insight. You know, we're really talking about a larger question here. And that question is, why do we organize ourselves into societies? Or do we do so to entrench and enrich and protect the prerogatives of the ruling class? Or do we do so to create conditions in which everybody has the opportunity to become fully human in whatever way suits them best? I opt for the latter. That's why we organize ourselves into societies.
Well, I don't know about organizing ourselves into societies. I just don't know that ever really is true.
Well, it's happened since the human beings have existed.
But organizing. And I'm worrying about the organizing.
And different sets of prerogatives have guided that at different stages in our evolution. But I think we've reached a level of sophistication and understanding, not only of our own natures, but of the universe, in which we can make a choice to organize ourselves in such a way as that people can live fully human lives. Okay. And if that means maybe that the rich aren't quite as rich, well, so be it.
Well, yeah. I agree.
Okay.
I also think it's important to understand that what most people know about most things is dependent on a media which is owned by the same people that you're criticizing.
Yes.
So there's some real problems.
Oh, definitely. We are outgunned.
That's why people ought to pay attention to us. That is KBOO. Not us, Abe and Joe. But
no, you. You and me.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Okay. 231-8187. Who do we got?
Mitch, good morning.
Yes. First of all, I really want to echo what Joe just said. And the last time I called in weeks ago...
No, it's what I just said, what Abe just said.
Well, I want to thank the fact that KBOO has the two of you guys who may both be leftists but are incrementally presenting nuanced differences that I have been wrestling with internally. And I thought that our general society, if they could... You know, if the audience of Rush Limbaugh were to wrestle with these internal contradictions, not only in capitalism, but in who we're competing with on the markets, and China is not capitalist like we're capitalists. They're centrally planned. They have their contradictions. We have ours. And what is happening in our so-called democratic mass media that's been captured by the corporations is that we don't have our body politic wrestling with the contradictions on all sides.
No, that's true.
And that is so important. I really appreciated you giving Michael the Libertarian, who started this whole thing with his first call there, an opportunity. And in the past, you also have, except when he's gotten a little too strident. But for the most part, you let him say his piece, and you try and probe at the contradictions he's not dealing with. And I'd like to raise one of those, which I also find that the mainstream, you know, capitalism, Uber, Alice spokespeople don't deal with, which is that we have heard ever since I was a kid that capital needs to be productive. And yet our wealth, that is held by the wealthy, has really not helped us build infrastructure, because when we allowed capital to leave the United States unfettered, I mean, that used to be a crime. It used to be limited, and if you went over the limits, you were guilty of capital flight. You went to jail. What we're doing now by having the government actually incentivize putting our capital abroad is that the capital is not generally going into investments even in foreign countries, which is why the working class of Korea that's killing us with Obama's 2011 trade deal, the Chorus, they're not that happy, even though their companies are doing great, because their companies are owned by a few families.
Right.
I think you're right on the money, but I would say, I would go you one further and say the problem is bigger than that even. Mm-hmm. Thomas Piketty, a French economist, wrote a wonderful book last year, Capitalism in the 21st Century, I think it's called, or Capital, something like that. In it, he posits an equation that reads like this: R is greater than G, meaning that in the current set of conditions, the return on investment in markets or whatever investors put, wherever they put their money, is greater than the rate of economic growth overall, meaning there's no incentive for the people who hold all the capital to give any of it to working people because they can make more money as investors than they can as investing in private equity markets. They can make more money there than investing in the growth of the general
economy.
They,
so the wealthy are not true job creators, despite Romney
and other
idiots.
And that's borne out by the reality of the outcomes. You can see that whenever there's a crisis, it is only the government that creates jobs. Everyone else, the stock market, goes up when jobs are cut because it cuts the cost.
Right, exactly.
So, but here's a point. Let me make this one point that I think even great economists like the one who preceded your program, Richard Wolff, sometimes don't make simple enough to understand. Let's say the people we gave our tax breaks to, the super wealthy, instead of putting their money in the Cayman Islands, were putting their money into factories in economies like Haiti that really could use some development, because that was the idea of allowing capital to be unfettered in the first place when Bill Clinton was selling it to us.
Right.
Because Reagan couldn't sell what Clinton did because Clinton had the unions behind him and was a Democrat and claimed to be creating jobs for America when, in fact, the opposite happened.
You are so correct.
The reason this happened is, and the reason our gonoffs or big thieves who take all the money offshore now and put it in unproductive, austerity equals, here's the formula, I don't know if I'm Einstein here, but it boils down this easily: austerity policies equal unproductive capital, which is deflationary. Because reason we're given is that the Germans are afraid, because after World War One there was the great hyperinflation, and in the meantime in America we had deflation. So we had no job growth, and people like William Randolph Hearst was making all their money by providing the weapons that would allow the Nazis, once they came to power, to rearm. And that's why if you look at the editorials in the early 20th century in the Hearst newspapers, they considered what Hitler was doing to be an economic miracle, even though Hitler was rearming Germany. Because they didn't know that World War II was coming. No. They didn't know that he'd invade Poland. So the simple formulation, before I get off the phone and let others call in, is that if we continue to allow our wealthiest to not pay taxes and to put the money in places like the Cayman Islands or Ireland, which is where Apple keeps their corporate profits, which explains why Ireland hasn't had the problem Greece has had. This is no economic miracle in Ireland. This is just the fact that they're benefiting by corporate loopholes, and that's where the money is sitting. Now, if we took away that architecture that allows corporations like Apple to keep all their outside profits in Ireland and not contribute them, then it is in the interest of these money hoarders that all economies around the world be deflationary, because that way, without ever having to invest what they put in the Cayman Islands, the value of what they put in the Cayman Islands goes up and not down.
Yeah, no, I think that's you've made a very simple observation, and it's true. I don't mean simple like dumb simple. I mean simple like essentially simple.
Right, but we're not dealing with that contradiction on our side. When I say our side, Joe, by the way, I'm a little bit more to Abe's side in that, like Franklin Roosevelt, I would like to save capitalism, but the capitalism I want to save is like the Scandinavian model, where their capitalistic companies are out trading ours and out producing ours. We have nothing in America that grew like IKEA. So everyone in America that calls Sweden a communist country like the Tea Party does,
is
or they
ignorant.
Call Obama a communist, they're really helping blur the truth, which is that Sweden takes care of its people, but they don't allow the hyper-rich as capital to go to unproductive hoarding places offshore.
You're absolutely right.
We need to let you go. I think you made some very good points.
Well said, sir.
And thank you for being there and doing it. Bye.
Okay. That was an excellent call.
Okay. You're evaluating the calls now?
We always evaluate the calls.
Do we? Okay.
Yeah. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9, alternative radio physicist, scholar, and social activist Vandana Shiva speaks on radical compassion. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints is off today. Instead, we'll hear Law and Disorder, featuring a history of the life and and work of Woody Guthrie in honor of the artist's upcoming centennial. At 11 on stage and studio, host Demi Roberts features two performing arts mini festivals with artistic directors Terry Mathern of Conduit's Dance Plus Festival and Jerry Tischlader of the Risk Reward Festival. And 11:30, Art Focus is off today. Instead, we'll hear an interview with historian William Hoagland, who talks about his book Founding Finance: How Debt, Speculation, Foreclosures, Protests, and Crackdowns Made Us a Nation. All this and more coming up today on KBOO.
Yes, and we want to continue our calls. I think we have some time for some more. All right, 2318187, who do we got?
Ed, good morning.
Good morning. I have to agree with you. That was an excellent call.
It was.
It was. Hard to follow.
Go for it.
I just wanted to say that I really believe that this the capitalist system as it is right now is completely broken. It is so slanted towards the wealthy that I'm not sure that it could ever be recovered. And it seems like we're just moving towards more and more from a local rich man's club to a global rich man's club.
Yes.
And there was an excellent book written several years ago, and it was by a man named John Perkins. It was called Confessions of an Economic Hitman.
Oh, I remember
yes,
that book.
Yes, we had him on this program.
And he talked, and it's very much what's going on now in Europe, but it took place in Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a system that was set up to enrich wealthy countries at the expense of poorer countries, and you know, they would put in these projects that would get in, you know, the money would go to American corporations and they would pay off the presidents of the countries and stick the people with the debt.
Right.
And then that made it, when they had to negotiate this debt, it made their natural resources worth pennies. And so these corporations and other people would come in and buy up their resources at nothing. And it got so bad that they even wanted to purchase the rights to the water and even the rights to the rain.
And that and all that water purchase issue is still a topic of concern in Latin America and here with Nestle ready to rip off our water.
But as far as our system here in the United States, I just wanted to give you two examples. We recently passed a legislation regarding the state tax where we gave almost like $3 billion to like 25 families.
Right.
And right now in Congress, they're trying to pass legislation to continue the health care for these 9/11 rescuers. Have you heard about this?
No.
Well, this was it was a law that they shamed Congress into passing to provide health care for these 9/11 firefighters and all these people that were exposed to all the asbestos and whatever, and it's up to for renewal in Congress now, and it's a terrible fight just to try to renew this. So you can just see that, the way the system is slanted, and it really needs to go back from away from this globalization and much more to a local resource-based economy. Anyway, thanks very much, you guys.
Yeah, thanks a lot for the call. I think we have time for one more caller.
Barth, make it fast, sir.
I can do that.
Okay.
perhaps you can correct me. Sorry about that. The moral hazard argument was, as far as I know, first used in Ireland during the potato famine, where the English-controlled state and landlords exported food and grain in large quantities out of the country and let the people starve because it would be a moral hazard for them to be on the dole or to even get a meal unless they worked for it. And hundreds, if not thousands, of people died working on road gangs where they were crushing rock and making road beds for roads that didn't go anywhere. And they would literally drop in their tracks because they were so hungry. And a lot of them would die. And over a million people, well, I don't know what the numbers are, but it's a huge number, just expired from their efforts and their hunger while the government said, you know, let them eat grass, and they did.
That's a perfect
Well, that's a good analogy. Example. And in fact, a huge number of those people came to the United States looking for a better situation. And we need some time to explore the whole question of immigration. You remind me of that, particularly in light of the incredible words of Donald Trump. Okay. Anyway, thanks a lot for the call, man.
Okay. Thank you.
Very quickly before we close, Brian writes into the Facebook page to say, I spent many happy months in Greece hitchhiking around, but mentioned the simple word Germany to a person, they turned into a bitter, bile-driven, hostile folks, especially the elderly ones. They remember how horribly they were treated by the Nazis in World War II, so there's a heavy animus towards the country that's driving the push to chuck Greece out of the Eurozone. Interesting.
No, and that's true. I mentioned earlier the struggle of the Greek partisans against the Nazis, incredibly brave, incredibly powerful, and a great story untold in the West, of course.
Great discussion today, everybody. Thanks for listening to our little economics lesson. And as always, we really appreciate your input.
Yeah, thank you very much. You stay tuned to KBOO because we deal with the real stuff and we have the best music in the land.
We'll see you next week.
Proud co-sponsor of the Portland Underground Grad School Series, Portland's Urban Native Americans, What You Need to Know to Be an Ally. Classes will start July 8th and continuing for 4 weeks on Wednesdays at 7 at Southeast Uplift in Portland. Classes will focus on issues such as federal policy toward Native peoples, inequities Portland's Native peoples face, blood quantum, and more. It will also address contemporary ideas of privilege, white fragility, and the complexities of intersectionality. Again, that's Portland's Urban Native Americans, What You Need to Know to Be an Ally, Wednesdays at 7 p.m. at Southeast Uplift, 3534 Southeast Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.